Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 20th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing today's decision in the City of Arlington versus FCC case decided just today by the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome to our program Columbia Law School Professor Tom Merrill, as announced earlier this morning, and we're also joined by Case Western Law School Professor Jonathan Adler. They're both Federalist Society regulars and leaders of different Federalist Society practice groups, so I'm not going to introduce them extensively. We're also joined today by a moderator for today's program, the leader of our Administrative Law Practice Group Executive Committee, Eileen O'Connor, of the Pillsbury Law Firm here in D.C. Now, all bios are available on our website, as always, so with that, let's get right to the substance. I'll turn things over to Lee O'Connor.
Thank you, Dean, and welcome everyone who has joined this call. As you know, this is being put together pretty quickly, right after the Supreme Court decided this morning the case of City of Arlington. In 1984, the Supreme Court decided in a case known by its nickname Chevron that courts should defer to agency interpretations of the laws it had asked them to administer, implement, or enforce. Since 1984, numerous decisions have been rendered because the scope of that deference is constantly under question. And that's exactly what happened in City of Arlington, a case which came to the Supreme Court from the Fifth Circuit. This morning's decision was written by Justice Scalia. It's 17 pages long. He was joined by Justices Thomas, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Breyer wrote a six-page concurrence in part and concurrence in the judgment. Chief Justice Roberts wrote a dissent. He was joined by Justices Alito and Kennedy. With that background, we're going to go first to Professor Merrill, who is going to tell us a little bit more about how the case arose, the questions it presents, and how the court addressed them. Tom?
Thanks very much, Lee. So, everybody always asks about any case that comes down, what was it about? This is an odd case because the court basically granted a cert on one question only, which was stated in an extremely abstract form. The question was whether a court should apply Chevron to an agency's determination of its own jurisdiction. So in theory, the court was not interested in what the case was about, although I think probably what the case was about had some subliminal effect on the lineup of the justices. As you may have noted from the brief description that Lee just gave, the liberal justices on the court were largely in support of Justice Scalia's opinion, or at least the outcome he reached, and three conservative justices, in an opinion by Justice Roberts, strongly dissented from that approach. The underlying issue has to do with the siting of wireless telecommunications towers, Wi-Fi towers and the like. And in 1996, Congress, as part of the Telecommunications Act, included a provision that said that the local land use agencies that have to give zoning permission for the siting of these towers could not unreasonably delay the decision as to whether or not to grant permission for such a tower to be constructed. The statute went on to say that if anybody was aggrieved by the timeliness of the land use decision, that they could seek review of the unreasonable delay in a court of competent jurisdiction. Statute didn't say anything about the FCC weighing in on this particular unreasonable delay issue. A number of years went by. A bunch of telecommunications providers got impatient with the siting process in many states, and they asked the FCC to issue a declaratory order to the effect as to what unreasonable delay would mean and to, in fact, prescribe time limits for how quickly state and local land use agencies had to act in order to avoid being found to have engaged in unreasonable delay. And the FCC obliged by issuing such a declaratory order. some local governments, the city of Arlington, Texas, city of San Antonio, Texas, and others, then challenged this in the Fifth Circuit on the grounds that the statute did not give the FCC any authority to interpret the unreasonable delay provision. It was pretty clear that the court in enforcing this was to the courts, mostly state and local courts, enforcing this were to be the ones to interpret what unreasonable delay means. The Fifth Circuit rejected that, saying that this is ambiguous, that there are some aspects of the statute that would support the FCC, some which would not. And under Chevron, the court should defer to the FCC's interpretation of the statute. So in effect, the court said that it would defer to the agency's interpretation of whether it had authority to interpret this section of the law or not. This then triggered the cert petition as to whether or not Chevron-type deference should apply to agencies' determination of the scope of their own regulatory authority. I think this may be, if not the most important case the court has rendered in the 30 years since the Chevron case was decided. It'd be a close second after the case of United States versus Meade Corporation some years ago. It really goes to the kind of crux of what's most puzzling about the Chevron case. The Chevron case is now widely understood to be about the allocation of authority between agencies and courts over the interpretation of statutes that agencies administer. Before Chevron, it was clearly understood that Congress could pass a statute that explicitly delegated authority to an agency to interpret a statute. And if Congress did this, the courts would review the agency's interpretation under a very deferential, arbitrary, and capricious type standard, and basically would follow the agency's interpretation unless it was clearly contrary to the statute or otherwise manifestly unreasonable. Chevron seemed to greatly extend this notion by saying that in many instances there's an implied delegation to the agency to interpret a statute. And when there is such an implied delegation, then the court should adopt essentially the same deferential standard of review, asking whether or not the agency's interpretation was arbitrary or plainly inconsistent with the statute. Maybe the fatal weakness in the Chevron opinion was that it was said virtually nothing about what the circumstances were in which courts should adopt this implied delegation idea. And so this has given rise to extensive disputes ever since the case was decided. The nub of the disagreement, first of all, the two opinions here are interesting, the Scalia opinion and the Roberts opinion, I guess I'll talk about. I won't say much about Justice Breyer. They're interesting rhetorically. Justice Scalia's majority opinion, joined by Justice Thomas and most of the liberals, really reads like a kind of legal realist tract. The main rhetorical thrust of Justice Scalia's opinion is that it's impossible to distinguish between agency jurisdiction and whether or not the agency was right on the merits. He refers to the distinction as a mirage. And so he goes on and on about how this distinction would be subject to manipulation, that there's no principled way of resolving it. And because the distinction is so intractable, he concludes that it can't really have any place in the Chevron-type analysis. So as long as the agency has authority to act with the force of law and has interpreted the statute with the force of law, it gets Chevron deference, even if the issue concerns the scope of the agency's authority. Justice Roberts, the rhetorical force of Justice Roberts' opinion is all about the importance of reining in runaway administrative agencies, that there's been an extraordinarily broad delegation of power to agencies. New agencies are being created all the time. These agencies are being given extensive new powers, and if we're going to preserve checks and balances within our system, we need to have some way in which courts can decide whether agencies are acting outside the scope of their delegated authority. We need to have some kind of ability for Congress and the courts to effectively check agencies when they begin regulating in broader and broader swaths of authority. And so Roberts sort of adopts a kind of more typical, I would say, conservative rhetorical framework. Scalia's rhetorical framework is very similar to legal realism or critical legal studies, oddly enough. And Robert's framework is much more separation of powers, checks and balances, the need to have constraints on executive aggrandizement of power, and so forth. Putting aside the rhetorical framework, both opinions talk a lot about precedence. Scalia cites, I think, on two pages, something like he discusses six different cases in which he says the court has, in the past, implicitly applied or has applied the Chevron framework in a case that involved the scope of the agency's authority or jurisdiction. And this supports the proposition that this is within the ambit of the Chevron doctrine. Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, cites a lot of cases in which the court has asked whether or not Congress delegated authority to the agency on a sort of specific basis, focusing on the actual clause of the statute in question, not asking the broader question of whether or not Congress had delegated in general to the agency to act with the force of law. So there's a lot of discussion. I would describe these as drive-by precedents of really not much consequence. The cases that Justice Scalia cites didn't really grapple with the issue of whether or not there was a Chevron should apply to agency jurisdictional determinations, and the cases that Chief Justice Roberts cites didn't focus on the question of how general or how specific the delegation has to be before we decide that the agency's been delegated the authority to engage in interpretation of the statute. The issue between the two opinions and before the court as it's defined in these opinions really comes down to this. It's whether or not both opinions, both Scalia and Roberts, I won't speak for Breyer, he's off on his own planet to some extent, but both the Scalia opinion and the Roberts opinion acknowledge that the question is whether there's an implied delegation of interpretational authority to the agency. Justice Scalia thinks that the way to answer that is on a sort of on the basis of an entire statutory code. So if the Federal Communications Act includes a clause somewhere granting the Federal Communications Commission rulemaking authority, that means, then the FCC uses something like rulemaking authority in resolving an interpretational issue about its own authority, then Chevron deference applies. All you need is some kind of delegation of rulemaking authority or adjudicatory authority somewhere in the general statute that is written in general terms, and that's enough to trigger Chevron deference to all issues about the scope of agency authority. Chief Justice Roberts thinks that the delegational inquiry has to be done sort of provision by provision, that, you know, the question in each case, at least potentially, would be whether or not, as to this provision of this statutory framework, Congress has decided that the agency should exercise interpretational authority. Obviously, that might be answered by looking to things like rulemaking grants or adjudicatory grants, but it would be open to the court to decide de novo, not giving deference to the agency, in each specific provision, whether or not Congress has given this authority to the agency or not. There isn't a lot of discussion in Justice Scalia's opinion affirmatively justifying this sort of cosmic proposition that, you know, one general rulemaking grant somewhere in the statute is enough to trigger Chevron deference to all subsidiary issues of agency authority. Other than something that Scalia has said in other opinions, which is he sort of likes the Chevron doctrine because it creates a sort of background principle against which Congress then legislates. He says this explicitly on page 5 of the slip opinion, that Chevron provides a stable background rule against which Congress can legislate. Statutory ambiguities will be resolved within the bounds of reasonable interpretation, not by the courts, but by the administering agency. Congress knows how to speak in plain terms when it wishes to circumscribe, and in capacious terms when it wishes to enlarge agency discretion. So Scalia's vision, not spelled out with too much justification, is that, you know, what we're really doing here is forcing Congress to speak very plainly about when it wants to transfer interpretational authority to somebody other than the agency once it gives the agency this general rulemaking or adjudicatory authority. Roberts makes a few substantive comments about the problems that this creates. He points out that a number of statutes are enforced by multiple agencies. What are we going to do in that case to figure out which one is entitled to decide the issue under Chevron? He points out that even within statutory frameworks, frequently Congress will differentiate in different parts of the statute about whether the courts, as opposed to the agency, are supposed to have interpretational authority, or maybe the state governments will have authority as opposed to the courts. And the sort of global approach of Justice Scalia will create problems, he says, in these sorts of situations. Let me just wrap up with a couple of brief comments for the sort of Chevron junkies listening in, and then I'll turn it over to Jonathan. One comment is that it appears to me, at least, that Justice Scalia has now accepted the Meade decision. This is the case of United States versus Meade Corporation, where the court, in an 8-1 ruling, said that a precondition of Chevron deference was that the agency had to have been delegated authority to act with the force of law, and its interpretation had to be rendered pursuant to that authority. Justice Scalia fulminated against this in his dissent in the Meade case. He said that the question should simply be whether or not the agency has rendered an authoritative interpretation of the statute, not whether it's acted with the force of law. And in a later case called Brand X, Scalia renewed his assault on the Meade decision in another lengthy, hotly written dissenting opinion. In the last part of today's decision in the City of Arlington, Scalia seems, as I read it, to accept the Meade decision. And in particular, he accepts Solicitor General Verrilli's argument in the case that all you need is Meade, that as long as the Meade conditions are satisfied, in other words, that the agency has the authority to act with the force of law and has exercised that authority interpreting, that gives the agency enough authority to decide these scope of authority or jurisdictional issues. But in order to lay out that understanding, which I assume was necessary to get the liberals to join his opinion, he has to now accept Meade. So I guess we'll not be reading any more vituperative opinions on that subject from Justice Scalia. The other interesting quirk is that Justice Thomas joins Scalia's opinion in Arlington. In previous Chevron cases, Justice Thomas had, I think, had a very a strong sense of Chevron as being grounded in specific delegations of authority to the agency, giving rise to this implied authority to interpret. His previous opinions had been much closer in tone, I think, to what Chief Justice Roberts writes in dissent in this particular case. So it's somewhat puzzling to me as to why now Justice Thomas has silently joined Justice Scalia, giving him 5 votes, along with the other liberals except for Breyer, in support of his opinion here. One can only speculate about what's going on behind the scenes in that regard. So with that, let me turn it over to Jonathan.
All right. Thank you, Tom. This is an initial matter. I don't have a lot to disagree with in terms of what Tom said, but I will accentuate a couple points and make a few other observations. First, in terms of the nature of the case and whether or not the specifics of the particular dispute between the City of Arlington and the FCC mattered, it's worth noting that this question has been one that's been percolating for a while, and there have been several attempts in the last several years to get the court to address this question. Typically, what would happen is a particular interest group or regulated entity would lose before an agency and find some language in a lower court opinion after it failed to successfully challenge the agency to latch onto and claim that this should be the basis for a grant of certiorari to resolve not only the particular dispute but the broader question about whether or not Chevron deference should apply to jurisdictional questions. And so there were quite a few cases in the past few years where litigants or petitioners had tried to piggyback their specific claims to this Chevron question, and the court had turned them away despite the existence of a fairly broad circuit split on this question. And when the court took this case, I think some were surprised because there was some question about whether or not this was the best vehicle whether or not the particular question that was at issue before the Fifth Circuit was really one that necessarily implicated the broader Chevron question, or whether it was just simply some imprecise language on the part of the Fifth Circuit that created the opening. Nonetheless, the court took it and, as Tom mentioned, restricted the grant to only the Chevron question. But despite that, at oral argument, several of the justices spent quite a bit of time trying to discuss the specifics of whether or not the FCC had acted properly in this case. And indeed, some of the briefs filed on the FCC side in the case, some of the merits briefs, actually argued that the FCC's decision should be upheld, but that the FCC should lose on the Chevron question. There's no way to know at this point, and perhaps we'll never know whether the specifics mattered in this case. But it is worth wondering whether or not a case in which there was a clearer claim of an agency extending its authority into new territory or engaging in what some might characterize as agency self-aggrandizement, whether or not that might have caused some of the justices to look at the case differently. And that relates to a broader point I'd like to make about the court's decisions in this area. I think this case is very significant, as Tom said. I also think the decision rests somewhat uneasily with the prior Chevron cases that we've seen in the last decade or so, cases like Mead and Brand X and Christensen. I think it rests uneasily with them because I think those decisions, Mead in particular, but all those decisions rested very clearly on a delegation theory of Chevron, a theory that the only authority an agency has to interpret a statute is that which Congress has delegated to it, whether explicitly or implicitly. And so thus, the default is that the agency does not have that authority. That is the default that one could say is articulated in Marbury versus Madison, perhaps less or more pedestrianly, we could say it's the default that is expressly endorsed in the Administrative Procedure Act when it says that it is for courts to determine questions of law in the first instance, and that you therefore need a deliberate congressional departure from that baseline. The alternative theory of Chevron, which certainly some academics have embraced over the years, and I think that Justice Scalia is very sympathetic to, is less focused on the delegation question and more focused on the question of comparative institutional competence and the comparative degree of accountability between agencies and the courts. All know that Justice Scalia, across a wide range of areas, has expressed the concern that judges not intrude upon the policymaking arena, that they not intrude upon the proper province of the legislative and executive branches. And Justice Scalia has expressed the concern in this context that if you open the door too broadly to judicial interpretation of statutes, to letting judges make what are difficult discretionary judgments about the proper way to apply a statute, particularly when it's very clear what the policy implications of that might be, that's the sort of temptation that will lead to judges substituting their policy preferences for agencies. And I think, you know, one can see this in throughout Justice Scalia's both opinions as a justice, but even in some of his academic writing and his preference for rules over standards. I think up until Arlington, most of the post-Chevron cases, and again, particularly cases like Mead, have not been as concerned about the need to constrain judicial discretion and the need to create these bright-line rules, but more concerned with being true to the notion of where agency authority comes from. It's not clear to me that all of the justices necessarily have had a fully formed administrative law jurisprudence, but I think the thrust of these cases had been rather consistent. And while I agree with Tom's characterization of the precedents that both sides cite as some drive-by precedents, I think the pattern of the substance of the court's decisions had been fairly consistent in that the court had been fairly careful to not confer deference to an agency's interpretation of its authority. In any case where what was really at issue was whether or not an agency had the authority to do something in the first place, it's hard to find cases in which the court actually deferred to the agency's interpretation. If you look at cases like Brown and Williamson and the like, the court tends to resolve those questions at step one or simply doesn't even bring Chevron up at all. And so I think there was a clear pattern there, but it's a pattern that whenever the court articulated it as being about delegation, as in Mead, Scalia dissented. I hope that Tom is correct, that Scalia has made his peace with Mead, even if he didn't follow Mead's premises to what I think are their logical conclusion. But my guess is that this is actually something of a rearguard action, that Justice Scalia realizes the rest of the court, at least right now, is not willing to reconsider Mead, this is the best way to preserve as broad a range of agency authority as possible, given the alternative of giving courts license to come in and answer some of these questions. And so for me, I think the big distinction between Justice Scalia and the dissent, Chief Justice Roberts' dissent, is this view about what the default rule should be and whether or not we should be more concerned about judicial discretion or agency discretion, whether we should be worried about judges deliberately or not substituting their policy preferences for agencies in the guise of interpreting ambiguous statutory language, or whether we should be more concerned about giving agencies the ability to determine the scope of their own authority. And Chief Justice Scalia about the former. I'll say a tiny bit about Justice Breyer. Tom is right that his opinion is in its own world and is very much what we've come to expect from Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer does not share Justice Scalia's concern about judges making these sorts of decisions. In fact, Justice Breyer is typically quite confident that judges and justices are capable of deciding when an agency should get deference and when it shouldn't, and doesn't see the need to create or rely upon a default rule or a broad presumption, and rather quite explicitly says, we can look at everything. His starting place seems to be fairly close to the Chief Justice, and that he does think that the question of whether Congress has delegated to an agency the authority to interpret a statutory provision is a question that courts must answer in the first instance, and he thinks that they should do so broadly. And in this case, he thinks it was perfectly reasonable what the FCC did. Was perfectly consistent, and that the statutory provision at issue did create a gap for the agency to fill. So, in terms of the underlying Chevron question, in some respects, Justice Breyer is actually closer to the Chief Justice's opinion, and so in that respect, the case is almost a 5-4 or maybe a 5-1-3 opinion. The one thing I just think that it's worth thinking, your last point I'll make in terms of thinking about this opinion and other things the court is doing, Justice Scalia has indicated his dissatisfaction with our deference, what some call Seminole Rock deference, the doctrine that says that when an agency interprets an ambiguous regulation, that the agency should get deference that is equivalent to or perhaps even stronger than the deference that the agency gets when interpreting an ambiguous statutory provision under Chevron. Justice Scalia has made it very clear that he is uncomfortable with that. He thinks it creates incentives for the agency to engage in behavior that could aggrandize its own behavior. Congressional intent. I think there is some tension between Scalia's...
Jonathan. Sorry, this is Dean Reuter. You're fading out, if you could speak a little
longer. I think there's some tension between Justice Scalia's view of our and his opinion here, and it'll be interesting to see if he addresses that tension if and when the court decides to reconsider our deference as he has suggested the court should. And I'll stop there.
This is Tom. Could I make one more little comment? Just listening to Jonathan, it occurs to me that it's a very interesting opinion from the perspective of the debates over delegation and the delegation doctrine. We usually think of the delegation doctrine as concerned with how precise Congress has to be when it delegates authority to an agency, whether it has, you know, spoken in too vague a generality or whether it has articulated an intelligible principle for the agency to follow. This case is really about the breadth of delegation in many respects, not the precision of the delegation. And Justice Scalia's opinion effectively says that, you know, as long as the agency's been given some kind of general rulemaking grant or maybe a general power to adjudicate with respect to the statute, that should be should trigger a delegation to engage in resolution of interpretive questions about the scope of its authority under the entire statute. And so it really, I think, countenances an enormously broad delegation from Congress to the agency that may be, in a way, much more of a transfer of power to the administrative state than what we typically associate with the broad delegations that have been the subject to non-delegation challenges.
I think that's a good point, and I think, you know, it's worth noting that Justice Scalia has never been, well, I guess with the exception of Administrata, never been particularly willing to think about enforcing some version of a non-delegation doctrine. I also think, you know, if one looks at the implications of that view of delegation with, say, some of the things Scalia has written about standing, he wrote a famous article, I think it was in the Suffolk University Law Review, responding to a D.C. Circuit opinion that suggested that if it's not easy for citizen groups to sue agencies for violating legislative commands, that certain authorities and certain questions will essentially be lost in the bowels of the bureaucracy. Scalia's article had a more colorful way of putting it, but and in the article, Scalia says yes, exactly, and that's a good thing. There is an underlying view here that yes, agencies might sometimes behave badly, and they may not always be faithful agents of the authority that has been given to them by Congress. But that in and of itself doesn't mean we want the judiciary to get involved, and I think that impulse, which we've seen in other areas, is of Scalia's jurisprudence and writings, is implicit in much of his opinion today.
Excellent. You two are just the greatest panelists. I was about to jump back in and say, Tom, do you have any questions for Jonathan? Jonathan, do you have any questions for Tom? But you have gone ahead and engaged, and I encourage you to do that just a little bit more. Dean, I think, is going to get ready to invite people who are on the call to ask their questions. Is that right, Dean?
It is. You want to open the floor to questions, and then we can sort of go back and forth between your questions and audience questions?
That sounds good to me.
Okay.
Get people queued up.
We'll hear an announcement in a moment that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So stand by for that. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to those questions, let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. We've got one more telephone conference call scheduled this week, and that is for tomorrow at this same number, at this same time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have an in-depth discussion of another Supreme Court case, Bowman versus Monsanto, decided last week. We'll have four panelists tomorrow, including our moderator. And right now, today, we've got three questions pending. Lee, should we go to the first audience question?
Sure.
Hi, this is Ken Quinnett at Pillsbury. Thank you very much for the discussion. I guess I'm one of these Chevron groupies, and for those of us who in part make a living off agency challenges, it comes across at the City of Arlington as a decision is quite a pro-government, pro-agency position of great deference, so long as you have a general grant of rulemaking authority. And I wonder what is left then of Skidmore-type deference, less deference, and in between, I guess for Professor Merrill, that it's not adopting a Scalia view of the world as long as it was authoritative to accord it Chevron deference. At the same time, it's not adopting a Breyer view of the world that says whenever an agency's followed procedures that guarantee a kind of deliberation and reflectiveness with public input, that's entitled to more deference. Were we left with trying to challenge agency actions that are not rulemaking themselves, is it just the fact that they've got to say they've got a general grant of authority, and as long as it's not arbitrary, we're left hanging and going to the legislature to try to enact change? Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. I think as I read this opinion, Scalia, at least for the moment, has thrown in the towel in his crusade against Mead. Now, he doesn't talk about Skidmore deference. That would be expecting too much for him to actually acknowledge that there is such a thing as Skidmore deference. But I think the logic of his embracing Mead means that the Mead analysis would still apply. So if an agency does not have the authority to act with the force of law, if it's just, got sort of advisory powers, or if it's something like the EEOC that doesn't have substantive rulemaking authority with respect to many of its functions, then an interpretation by the agency would not qualify for Chevron deference under Mead, and therefore you would still apply Skidmore, even if the, without regard to whether the issue was jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional. Similarly, if the agency has been given authority to act with the force of law by rulemaking or by binding adjudication, but has not exercised that authority, for example, if it's spoken through an amicus brief or some type of, opinion letter or something like that, which is not legally binding, again, under Mead, you'd be in Skidmore land rather than in Chevron land, and I don't see anything in this decision as changing that. All this decision really says is that we're not going to sort of subdivide, the area that qualifies for Mead deference into a further subcategories of questions that are deal with the scope of agency authority and other types of questions that are clearly within the scope of the agency's authority. The Arlington case refuses to make that further subdivision within the Mead the area of deference that Mead says belongs to Chevron. So I think we still very much have a Skidmore-Chevron divide, but it's going to be determined strictly by the Mead distinction, not by whether or not the question is goes to the scope of the agency's authority or not.
Thank you.
Jonathan, do you want to speak to that?
I would agree with Tom. I think that's right. I mean, whether or not Scalia is actually thrown in the towel or is just keeping his powder dry, who knows? But I think Tom's breakdown of its implication for Skidmore deference is correct.
All right, we've got two more questions pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next audience member.
Hi, Tom and Jonathan. It's Kristen Hickman. Quick question that I've been wrestling with as a fellow Chevron junkie. Under the, I have my qualms about Scalia's opinion and, many areas of agreement with Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. One issue that I've been trying to grapple with and would appreciate your thoughts on is under the provision-by-provision approach to the Mead framework that at least implicitly is envisioned by Chief Justice Roberts, if you apply Mead and Chevron sort of formalistically, as I think most of the lower courts do, then what would be left for Chevron Step 1 if we put the jurisdictional versus non-jurisdictional question at Mead? Did that make any sense at all?
Tom, do you want to field that one, Tom?
I'm not quite sure. We're all talking about step zero here, So Mead is step zero, and Arlington was proposing a new, element of step zero. So if Arlington had gone the way Chief Justice Roberts would have had it go, step zero would have included inquiries both as to whether or not the agency was had the authority to act with the force of law, and it acted with the force of law, and whether the agency, whether the question dealt with the scope of the agency's authority or was just within the scope of its authority. If all that was resolved in favor of the preconditions for Chevron applying, then you would shift to step one, and then you would ask the question of whether or not the statute was clear and unambiguous, or whether it was ambiguous. So I don't really think that step one is eliminated one way or the other by how you come out in Arlington. Jonathan mentioned, and I think it's quite right, that in a number of cases like Brown and Williamson and maybe Dole versus Steelworkers, the court had essentially resolved questions about the agency acting within the scope of its jurisdiction at step one. I sort of view those cases as ones in which the court was avoiding the Arlington issue. It was kind of like putting that issue to one side and supervising the agency's exercise of its authority, but through a kind of a flexible exercise in step one. I mean, Brown and Williamson, for example, it's very difficult to say that the statute clearly precluded the agency from regulating tobacco. I mean, the statute was broad enough to authorize the agency to regulate tobacco on its face, and the court goes into an elaborate exercise of the history of the statute and congressional responses to various decisions and non-decisions by the FDA and so forth, and coming up with the conclusion that Congress had not intended FDA to have authority over tobacco. So that's pretty close to what I would regard as a de novo review of the question of jurisdiction, but it done under the guise of step one. And I think what was being proposed in Arlington is that, you know, you would shift this inquiry into the scope of the agency's authority back to step zero and would actually apply de novo review to that question before you ever got to the Chevron framework.
Do you want to weigh in, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think there are lots of questions that fit within a typical Chevron step one versus step two framework that don't implicate the delegation question or the jurisdiction question that it really was an issue here. I mean, so for example, in a various environmental statute, you may have terms that are somewhat ambiguous. What constitutes a stationary source? What constitutes a modification? What constitutes an increase in emissions? Is increase defined against a particular baseline or not? Do you look at, a facility as a whole? Do you look at smokestack by smokestack? I mean, those sorts of questions, I think, are the sorts of policy questions that we very easily can say are delegated to an agency's policy judgment, and that we can believe that Congress implicitly delegated to an agency's policy judgment, even if Congress never expressly said the administrator shall answer the following questions. And I think the part of the power of part of the rhetorical power of Scalia's opinion, even though I disagree with it, is that it is somewhat difficult ex ante to provide a very crisp definition of what sorts of questions are quote-unquote jurisdictional questions and what ones aren't at anything other than a very broad level. And I think that's part of, what Scalia is concerned about and that it's just too easy to manipulate. I happen to think that when you actually look at the cases, they actually tend to fall pretty, or the questions in individual cases, they happen to fall pretty neatly onto one side of the line or the other. I think it's kind of like, saying that the existence of twilight means we can't distinguish night from day. No, we can, and we know how to distinguish night from day. We know that there are possibly instances that are going to be on the line. The question is whether or not the prospect of a difficult line drawing exercise means you don't engage in the exercise, which is, I think, Scalia's opinion, or whether you engage in it just recognizing that there are going to be some tough calls. But I don't think, had the dissent prevailed, though, it would have really eliminated step one. I think it would have really made Chevron deference about the sort of policy implementation questions that at least I think some people think Chevron is most properly concerned with.
Mm-hmm. That leads to...
Can I throw in a couple more points about this, since we didn't really get to it in our opening comments, about Justice Scalia's legal realist essay about how you can't distinguish between the scope of agency authority and the application of agency authority and so forth. I think his opinion, in a way, is kind of internally contradictory, because he says that this distinction is meaningless or, you know, subject to, or a mirage, as he puts it. But then he proceeds to go on for many cases, many pages, citing a whole bunch of cases where he says, well, this was clearly a jurisdictional issue and we applied the Chevron framework. And this was clearly a case about the scope of agency authority and we applied the Chevron framework. How can he identify all these cases that involve the scope of the agency's authority so easily if this distinction is a mirage and meaningless? I mean, he seems to himself have an intuitive appreciation for the kinds of issues that implicate the scope of agency authorities and the ones that don't. And if he can do that, why can't other judges do that? He also addresses the point which that courts all the time distinguish between whether they have jurisdiction over a case and whether what the legal terms are for resolving the case on the merits. And he acknowledges that this distinction is deeply rooted in the law and that the courts implement this distinction almost on a daily basis. So the question then is, you know, if it's easy for courts to ask of themselves whether they have jurisdiction or don't, as opposed to whether the case is correctly decided or not, why can't we ask that about agencies? And all he says really is that, well, in the case of an agency, the scope of the agency's authority and the legal constraints on its action are in the same statute, or they're both statutory. They're both provided by Congress. But, you know, the court's jurisdiction is frequently given by Congress. Now, often it's in a different statute than the statute that governs the merits of the case. So it might be somewhat easier to distinguish jurisdictional from non-jurisdictional questions for that reason. But that doesn't really go to the conceptual question of whether or not this is a meaningful distinction or not, or one that, you know, people could apply in a non-arbitrary fashion. You know, sometimes I ask my students in administrative law, you know, I give them a whole bunch of cases and say which ones involve agency jurisdiction and which ones don't. There's a very broad consensus about which ones are jurisdictional and which ones aren't. It's the kind of thing that lawyers have a very strong intuitive appreciation of. And so this kind of critical legal studies treatment here by, of all people, Justice Scalia, really strikes me as kind of bizarre.
Interesting. Jonathan, do you want to weigh in on that point?
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, though, but generally about the fact that a distinction can be drawn, it's the sort of distinction that can be drawn fairly reliably in practice, but is difficult to articulate, you know, a precise formula. And I think Tom's observation about the method of Scalia's opinion is a good one.
I'd like to ask you both whether you think that the opinion, the majority opinion as it came out, or conversely, if the dissent had won over the day, whether the opinion will encourage or discourage challenges to agency authority. Tom?
Well, I think the majority opinion is clearly going to discourage challenges to agency authority. I mean, this is going to... you know, this is perhaps one of the most important expansions of mandated judicial deference to agencies that we've ever seen, and it eliminates a potentially powerful argument, you know, against agency action that they've drifted beyond the scope of their authority, as it has historically been understood, as it was intended by Congress, as perhaps, you know, has the sort of implicit equilibrium that's been reached. All those sorts of arguments for, you know, against agency aggrandizement are going to be very difficult to make if you have to show that there's some kind of clear textual basis for limiting the agency's authority. And that's what Justice Scalia's opinion basically demands, that, you know, Congress has to speak with clarion precision if it wants to have some entity other than an agency decide questions about the agency's authority. So I think this is a big day for the administrative state. This is, James Landis would be proud.
Jonathan?
I was just chuckling at Tom's last comment. But, yeah, no, I think that's true. I think this will, folks that have taken issue with an agency action and need to challenge it. I think they're going to need to challenge it. I think what will be interesting to see is the effect of this decision both on agency behavior and on the lower courts. I mean, prior to this decision, lower courts had been split on this question. I'd even argued in a co-authored paper that the D.C. Circuit, which is arguably the most important on this question, given its particular caseload, was actually itself split and had opinions on both sides of the question. I think that agencies now will feel a little more room to try and expand their statutes, and at a time in which it is difficult to amend statutes and revise statutory language, this is certainly a gift to agencies that want to update their programs and were concerned about whether or not they could do so within the confines of their statutory grants of authority. I also think that this may make lower courts a little less aggressive in policing agency interpretations. I think there's a related question that's come up in some of these cases about what inference should a court draw from Congress's failure to address a specific question. And the D.C. Circuit had said in multiple cases that if Congress fails to withhold authority, that is not a grant of authority, nor is it an ambiguity. It is a failure to grant, if a failure to withhold authority is in effect it's not a grant, is a silence. And that what agencies need is an actual grant. The default is agencies having no authority. And there are a bunch of cases where agencies had said, well, Congress didn't tell us we couldn't. One of the cases was American Bar Association versus the Federal Trade Commission. Federal Trade Commission said, well, Congress didn't say we couldn't regulate attorneys too. The D.C. Circuit said, no. That's the sort of thing you would have needed to get express authority to do. While this opinion doesn't directly address those cases, the method of, that Scalia adopts with regard to when agencies have interpretive authority or not does seem to adopt this very agency-friendly construction of, once you have any authority, you have it all, unless Congress expressly withheld something.
So for practical purposes, today's decision essentially eliminates one ground for challenge.
Perhaps. The counterargument would be that Scalia's or that the opinion is only applying that notion to the question of interpretive authority, not to agency authority more broadly. But I would certainly expect agencies to try and use that argument to justify a broader assertion of authority where Congress has not expressly withheld.
Yeah, let me give you a specific example. So there's been a number of instances recently in which agencies have exercised waiver authority to grant enormously broad waivers of like No Child Left Behind statute or the Affordable Care Act and so forth. And a lot of these statutes have little provisions in them that say, the agency may grant waivers, and the legislative history and the tradition behind these things sort of suggests that the purpose of these waiver provisions was to allow for, little pilot projects and experimental approaches by states that might have been equally effective as the original mandated procedure, but we're sort of trying something different. So the agency now comes along and uses this grant of waiver authority to excuse, compliance with a huge broad swath of statutory requirements. And under the Arlington case, the agency, if it's challenged on this, will now say, well, it's ambiguous as to what waiver means, and so we construe waiver to mean you can waive everything. And that's just the scope of our authority, and we get Chevron deference over that.
Dean, we have a question pending.
We do. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Warren Belmar with a more general question for the panel. And it really relates to whether this will have a salutary effect or a negative effect on the way in which Congress goes about writing statutes. Are we going to see a search for ambiguity so as to allow the agency to craft its own charter, or are we going to see Congress in writing statutes being more specific.
Like they were in Obamacare.
Right.
How now?
You know, it's very hard to say. I think there's some studies that suggest that, you know, Congress has been very slow to pick up on the sort of textualist approach to interpretation, which implicitly is designed to create more incentives for precise drafting or clarity on the part of Congress when it legislates, that, you know, Congress is too busy cutting deals and, you know, kind of delegating to staffers and interest groups and so forth, drafting of statutes to have any kind of systemically directed, you know, attention to this whole issue of statutory drafting. So I'm somewhat skeptical that, you know, this case, unlike, you know, a bunch of other cases that adopt sort of a textualist approach, will suddenly change the way Congress drafts statutes. You know, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would point out, though, that in some respects, one takes a public choice view of congressional behavior and views members of Congress as often trying to evade accountability for difficult choices, then this decision in some respects is helpful because Congress can continue to enact vague statutes. And now the authority to interpret those statutes will more clearly be in the hands of agencies, and it's very easy to beat upon the agency if the agency adopts or implements the law in a way that the member of Congress didn't like, and makes it even easier for the member of Congress to avoid accountability. The member of Congress doesn't have to worry about the court offering an authority, or is less concerned about the court offering an authoritative interpretation that the member of Congress might feel responsible for. Now it's clearly in the hands of an agency, which has some degree of policy discretion, the head of which can be, you know, dragged before a congressional committee for a hearing, or can be sent a letter with various questions. And, you know, we see that kind of behavior all the time of members of Congress who vote for statutes. They're poorly drafted or they're ambiguous in certain respects, and then they immediately turn around and attack the agency for doing what you would have expected the agency to do with that language. And you know, this case, if anything, I think would you know, facilitate that practice.
Well, it stands the delegation concept on its head to think that it was at one point somewhat limited in terms of what could be delegated to, you know, what's now turning out to be abdication of legislative responsibility in some respects. I guess the area that strikes me the most on that is the congressional opposition to the enforcement of the Defense of Marriage Act, but I'm not aware of any legislative proposals to repeal that statute in the Senate or the House. They're leaving it to the courts instead, and this is another example of leaving the responsibility to someone else rather than the legislature.
Good point. Thank you, Warren, for calling in. I just looked and saw that Ed Whalen posted on National Review today a brief skim of the opinion and raised pretty much a lot of the same points that you, Tom, and Jonathan have. In particular, I'll note that he says that Justice Breyer's separate opinion concurring in the judgment seems to be more consistent with the chief's dissenting general approach, meaning that there actually is a 5-4 divide on the court in this case rather than the 6-3 that just counting up the opinions would suggest.
Well, I agree with Jonathan's point that if this issue had come up in the context of something like the Ashcroft opinion that you know, prohibited the use of scheduled substances for assisted suicide or something like that, you know, where the agency was seen as, you know, adopting a kind of conservative social policy in opposition to liberal progressive policies adopted by states or something like that, that some of the justices that joined Scalia could very easily have joined an opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts.
Very interesting. Dean, my clock tells me that we have hit the magical termination hour.
We are. We have indeed. Let me thank our moderator, Eileen O'Connor, for joining us today, and I want to thank as well Professors Adler and Merrill for their comments. And I want to invite our audience to join our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at the same number at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be looking at the another Supreme Court case, Bowman versus Monsanto. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.